don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. We have another quick read today, and it's going to be this is a fun one. I can't wait for part three. This will be a three-part series when it's actually completed, but only part one and two are out right now. This is a Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin, and it was posted by Hasu. You can find him at HasuFly on Twitter, and it's written by him and Suju. Both are on Twitter. If you're not following them, you really definitely need to be. Suju can be found at ZHUSU, and HasuFly is at HASUFLY. So those are their Twitter tags. Obviously, I'll tag them in the posts and everything, so they'll be really easy to find. This first one is an honest account of fiat money. And if you don't know, HasuFly posts things pretty regularly. We've read a number of things on the show by Hasu, and it's usually a very interesting interpretation of the vision or the ideas of Bitcoin. I've always had a lot of fun reading his work in particular about that topic. But both of them did a wonderful job with this article, and it's short, the arguments laid out are, I think, will promote some really fun discussion and thought on this topic, as per usual with these authors. So, without further ado, I don't want to lead it too much. We're just going to jump right in to An Honest Account of Fiat Money, A Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin, Part 1. Bitcoin has an immense pull on all critics of the current fiat system. Bitcoiners tend to be sound money advocates, meaning they prefer money that can't be created or destroyed by a central party and instead has a fixed or at least predictable supply, like gold, instead of one where the government can centrally manage the money supply. While sovereign money has undeniably led to a lot of abuse, as evidenced by instances of hyperinflation, seizures, or capital controls, the absence of all control brings problems of its own. In the example of the euro, countries entered a monetary union without a fiscal union. The result is a currency that strongly benefits the export-oriented nations like Germany, while hurting net importers like Greece or Portugal. Fiat is incredibly useful when people want their country to have monetary sovereignty. Ceding control over the money supply to a foreign institution, for example by pegging to an uncontrollable asset like gold or Bitcoin, removes the ability to tailor the monetary and economic policy of your money to the needs of your economy. Benefits of sovereign money. Fiat proponents would say that each country has its own economic problems that need personalized solutions. That's why the UK, Norway, or Sweden never joined the euro, and most of the southern European countries today regret it. Monetary sovereignty, on the other hand, unlocks certain benefits for countries. 1. The government can better finance large social projects and benefits by printing more money, which is good for beneficiaries of such a welfare state. 2. The government can demonetize or freeze assets easily, which is good for anti-crime. Most people aren't criminals, but want to be protected from crime. 3. The government can manage fiat liquidity with the goal to kickstart the economy when needed and smoothen business cycles. 4. The government can keep the currency stable against a basket of goods and services to increase its usability in the economy. And 5. Countries can devalue their currency in international trade to boost their exports and to reduce their trade deficit. Contentious inflation. Because governments tend to create more money than they destroy, the value of fiat money erodes over a long enough time against all real assets. And since creating new money doesn't create new wealth, the seigniorage from spending it first can be seen as an implicit tax on all other holders of the money. A small level of inflation is no side effect of fiat money, but is actively targeted by central banks today. Inflation incentivizes firms and households to invest into productive enterprises and makes it easier for the government to meet future obligations, as nominal debts slowly become easier to pay off when each unit of money loses a bit of purchasing power. It's also a great way to tax the shadow economy in places where compliance can be low and collecting taxes hard, like India, much of Africa, and South America. Is fiat inevitable? But the ability to tax through inflation is more than a tool for wealth redistribution inside an economy. It can also be used to gain an advantage in supranational competition. If China could endlessly allocate resources towards military production by printing more money, while the U.S. has to allocate via taxation, it would end in a huge uphill battle for the U.S. In that scenario, China would effectively borrow money from their own citizens via implicit taxation, but the money would flow back into their economy later from the spoils of a won war. So, while the observation of sound money advocates that the abolishment of the gold standard has led to more sustained warfare is not wrong, we can imagine the situation similar to the deterrence theory. While it might be better for the world at large to be on a sound money standard or have no nuclear weapons, the equilibrium would be unstable. Once one player abandons it, he forces everyone else to follow him to a new, inferior equilibrium. Another parallel is the rise of the nation-state itself, which quickly proved much stronger militarily than the feudal state, as rulers were able to create national armies. The newly emerging nation-states dominated all older forms of political organization, which forced the remaining actors to centralize into nation-states themselves. Fundamental problems. While the fiat system has many positives, the last decades have revealed some fundamental problems. If you want your money supply to be flexible, you still have to decide who gets to manage it. In our current system, central banks and governments have largely outsourced the creation and destruction of money to commercial banks. New money is created when these banks credit lender accounts without debiting someone else. For the liabilities they have towards their customers, they only need to keep a small fraction of actual deposits in reserve. This is known as fractional reserve banking. Unfortunately, that causes the vital functions of a financial system, which are 1. To facilitate payments, 2. To broker investments and loans, and 3. To provide insurance, to become hopelessly intertwined. If too many borrowers were to default on their loans, it could cause the entire system, including payments, to fail even for customers who never agreed to have their deposits invested in risky schemes in the first place. It also creates a severe disconnect between risk and reward for the financial sector. When gambling is allowed to take place on the same balance sheet as the payment system and other crucial parts of our financial infrastructure, the government becomes obliged to bail out banks once they get into trouble from their risky lending activities. That drives the banks to even riskier behavior, knowing that more volatility can only increase their upside as potential losses are capped. A new conversation on money. I think we can all agree that we have some fundamental problems in our current financial system. Too many system-critical companies cannot be allowed to go bankrupt because the different parts of the system are too interconnected and not at all modular. A crisis in any one part immediately spills over into the rest of the economy and puts the whole system at risk. Needless to say, that is not at all how you should design world-critical infrastructure. This is my favorite starting point for thinking about Bitcoin. It is more than fiat versus sound money. Bitcoin proponents are driven by a collective interest in exploring how we can evolve money for a better society and how we can make the global financial system more stable and distributed. The creators of Bitcoin didn't see how they could contribute to fixing the holes in the current system because of powerful incumbents who have a strong interest in preserving the status quo, so they found a way to compete with them. But it's not a hostile takeover attempt. Bitcoin's purpose is not to destroy, but rather to offer us freedom and choice, and in doing so, to spark a conversation about the nature of money and its crucial role in our society. Come back for part 2, Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract. All right, and that will close out the article. Like I said, this one was actually pretty short, ooh, there's a lot to unpack here. Don't forget, this is by Su Zhu and Hasu. Both will be tagged, and you can follow them on Twitter, and I will link to this article so you can drop some applause on it. And if you want to go ahead and get ahead of the game and read the second one, Unpacking the Bitcoin Social Contract, that one is out and available now. Part 3 is not out yet. But hopefully it will come soon and we will be able to cover it on the show. This is a pretty honest account of what someone defending the fiat system would say. There are a lot of caveats, and I think this is important. This is a purposeful on their part in writing this. But there are a lot of caveats that any of these supposed benefits of sovereign money are actually benefits. Like the idea that governments can finance large social projects by printing more money, which is stated good for the beneficiaries of such a welfare state. So the argument that it's better for society is left alone, which is smart. If these large social projects are financed with unsustainable money, it creates an unsustainable and systemic imbalance that cannot be corrected. And every one of these supposed benefits, well, practically all of the supposed benefits of sovereign money, basically reinforce that systemic risk. Another one was that the government can keep the currency stable or essentially manage the fiat liquidity to kickstart the economy and smooth out the business cycle. But it's completely ignoring the crucial role that contractions play in an economy. And bear markets in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency are a great example to actually compare it against. Bad, unsustainable companies do not survive through bear markets. Market contractions are absolutely critical to sustainability of an economy. You can't sustain systemic risk through a contraction. It is only through false pushing additional money and liquidity into a system that should be limited on liquidity, that should be allocating resources only to the most crucial things and only to the truly productive enterprises. It's exactly those times that keep those systemic risks from building. So you look at the history of the Federal Reserve and you see, quote unquote, they did actually smoothen out business cycles by pumping more money into the economy and more debt into the economy. But then you look at the chart for debt and you're growing into a cliff. You're just replacing 100 small bubbles with one giant one that cannot be escaped. Like we're getting to the point in the United States where the interest on the amount of money that is loaned is going to equal what is pulled into the government in revenue. That we just, everything that we are funding is funded on more debt. Like that, there's no coming back from that. Debt is exactly what has killed the vast majority of societies in the past. Every major civilization, Rome, all the great ones, were killed by debt. And to say that it's a benefit that the sovereign money, because we can kick the can down the road, is that's a benefit, I would absolutely argue that that's the opposite. And I think Hasu and Suju here are just saying that that is considered a benefit in the context of fiat money proponents, that it's not actually necessarily a benefit in the long run, but in the short term, it looks like one. It gives you good numbers and everybody's happy because you don't have a hangover after you get drunk. That, you know, rather than having to lose your job when you work for a shitty company that has risked or that has leveraged themselves to the ends of the earth and ruined resource allocation within the institution, they get bailed out and they don't lose their job. So in the short term, it seems like a benefit, and it would certainly be a proposed benefit of the fiat money system. But arguably, it's absolutely destructive at the core level to any sustainable society. It's antithetical to civilization in itself. And all of this stuff is inflation inherently is unethical, in my opinion. So I don't see any perceived utilitarian benefit to be a positive, because there is no, it's like saying you can kill somebody and, oh, well, it frees up more space on the sidewalk. Well, that's great, but you murdered somebody. So that's not a utilitarian argument for murder that I think has any ethical sounds in ethical argument for it. It's still absolutely 100% wrong. End of story. You're stealing from someone else. And the only reason it quote unquote works is because they don't know. They don't see that they're being stolen from. In addition, is despite the fact that society and technology has grown to create unbelievably productive societies, something like 99% of all hyperinflationary events have happened in the last 120 years. It has been since fiat money has dominated the world that the worst massacres of government and the worst atrocities of government have been executed, particularly early on in fiat money. World War I and World War II were utterly devastating. And it is only because, as they said in this thing, if one country can endlessly allocate resources towards military production by printing money and the other one only has taxation, then it's an uphill battle. It becomes a battle to the worst equilibrium where everybody is scaling up by taxing people through inflation, by the invisible tax, and in doing so, escalate the warfare that is possible in that situation. So that's actually one of the most interesting arguments that I have heard in the past, and I don't think we've ever really covered it on the show, that the idea of sound money, a sound money society cannot defend itself from one with sovereign money that can print to fund a military. And that's a really interesting thing, that the equilibrium would be unstable, that once, as soon as one player abandons it, and I think that's kind of what we saw. That's what we saw in the early 1900s, is as as countries began to abandon the gold standard, and one that was able to inflate their money in order to allocate resources toward military conquest, it became so obvious and so out of balance that pretty much everyone had to play along. Everyone had to start doing this themselves. They'd have no way to they'd have no way to defend themselves in this new equilibrium, this warfare equilibrium. And what's interesting is that you get a situation where it's a battle for who's got the strongest currency, because that is the one that allows them to have the military expenditure that that creates the more powerful military and the more powerful force of war. Conquering other lands or other countries and then instituting a backing or a monopoly of your currency in that new country or in that new region bolsters the victor's ability to spend more on their military. That's why the United States, with the dollar being practically the world reserve currency, has ridiculous multiples of military expenditure and weaponry than any other country. I mean, like, you combine, I think it's, the number's stupid. It's like you combine the next, like, countries 2 through 10 on the list, and you still don't have the amount of expenditure and military production that the United States have. United States has. We could blow up the world, 10 times or something with the number of nukes that we have. It's just stupid. It's just a game of face. Like, none of it's actually practical or utilitarian. Like, there's no need for that amount of military force. It's just a never-ending deterrent. It's a look how much we could just obliterate everything. So we're the big dogs. But what's interesting is, because gold could be so easily controlled as far as a medium of exchange and store of value within a country, within a sovereign state, it failed to actually defend against that unstable equilibrium. And I think that's what leads to that situation where one country abandons it and gets the ability to inflate their money to create selfish, politically selfish goals, to fund politically selfish goals that the people wouldn't actually do themselves. Like, once you get to that point, you create a state that is so powerful that other states have to do it or they cannot defend against it. But I think that's a consequence of the fact that the people cannot defend themselves against the state in the monetary sense, which is why I think the conversation around Bitcoin is very different. Because the question is, does a fiat currency that is being abused survive in the face of people being able to privately and without telling their government, which they would be less inclined to tell their government if they saw that they were having to protect themselves from the value loss of another currency. They might actually be inclined to be honest and willingly pay taxation if it was actually being used for services and purposes that they wanted. That's supposedly the nature of government is that, oh, we're all getting together and working on these big services that we all want, but then 90% of the money goes to destroying countries that we can't even point out on a chart and or point out on a map and that nobody knew about until the politicians started talking about how we really, really needed to bomb them for whatever reason they made up at the time. But inevitably, these fiat systems have the biggest problem, the fundamental imbalances and such that are talked about later on towards the end of this article, particularly the one with commercial banks, I think still sort of ignores the fundamental problem of a system with a massive conflict of interest and vulnerability to abuse. There is no way to make a centralized system that is run by humans not susceptible to abuse, not susceptible to, that's what happened to the gold standards. People stopped using gold and they used centralized tokens that represented gold. They're, gold notes. And as soon as it becomes a centralized system that is run on authority and trust, that trust is abused because it is simply too beneficial to whoever starts abusing it. And once one person does, so many others start to do it too, or they get left behind. The honest players in the system are the ones that fail. It's similar to if you've ever read the Selfish Gene. It's a evolutionarily unstable equilibrium. No, it was a different word. I can't remember what it was. Basically, if you create a system that can be abused, people will begin to abuse it, and then the abusers, the ones who corrupt and become corrupt and become the liars and the cheaters of the system. If the game can be cheated, then the cheats will be the ones who succeed. But the underlying point of the game is to produce so that there's a productive society. And if cheaters are the ones that are winning, well, then cheating outweighs eventually, just as a consequence of time, no matter how small the imbalance and corruptibility is at the beginning, cheaters inevitably outbalance the producers, and then the whole thing collapses. And that's, as he said, that is not how you should design world critical infrastructure. And it's why a gold standard was sustainable, but wasn't as soon as the economy became so fast that it had to be allocated to a trusted third party. And without those constant economic contractions, without those bear markets to weed out the cheaters, without the cost of cheating or abuse being borne by the cheaters and abusers, as soon as you start pushing it into the hands of politics, well, then it's just the charismatic cheaters always win because everybody can be fooled into believing any stupid thing for voting. Everything that we think consumers are stupid about, they're at least spending their own money, but voters are stupid in an astronomically worse way because they don't have any skin in the game. Their being wrong doesn't ruin them. It forces the cost onto someone else. So all you have to do is have a pretty picture, get your lighting right, wear a suit, and be very charismatic, and they'll just vote power into the hands of a select few of people, and the cheaters will get more and more profitable. The abusers will get more and more powerful within the system, and it will become unprofitable. It will become worthless to be a producer because cheaters are the ones who win. It's why in today's economy, you'll never find a large company that doesn't spend an enormous amount of money on lobbying, that doesn't have a massive legal team, that doesn't play the stock price shareholder game. It's all become a huge game of politics, and they will get left behind. Think about it. Any bank that did not participate in fractional reserve would go out of business in no time. They would be outcompeted in a matter of weeks, probably, because they would be severely limiting themselves to any ability to profit or have income and interest on deposits or interest on loans and investments, because they're cutting out 90% of what they have available to invest by not making new money out of thin air for those loans and investment. So they literally go out of business. It's impossible to be an honest bank in a fractional reserve system. And that's why the entire thing has such a systemic risk, because as soon as you introduce the ability to cheat and profit, and there's no pushback against it, there's no way to isolate failure within the system to those people who abuse it, you make that systemic across the entire economy, honesty is literally outlawed. It becomes the fastest route to failure in the economy, at least in our example for banks. In a fractional reserve banking system, an honest bank cannot survive. Only fractional reserve banks are successful in that scenario. And then even worse, to have it that because the problem becomes the imbalances and problems become so systemic that they get bailed out, it's like, why would you ever change your behavior? Like, you have zero incentive to do so. You can't compete on an honest scale because all the cheaters will outcompete you, and you're rewarded for cheating when everything goes belly up and the government still just takes the already abused citizenry who have had their wealth confiscated for the systemically failed system to begin with are now being confiscated from again to bail out the failed system. So it's a endless feedback loop of corruption and abuse that even if players are trying to be honest, it can't be done. So it doesn't matter whether the people in the system, quote unquote, are good or bad. It matters whether the system profits cheaters or honesty. I think fiat money is inherently, and then maybe this is just my clearly passionate opinion about it, or my research has possibly been very one-sided in this since I have discovered the ethical concept of money production. I think it's inherent to the system. I don't think there is a way out of that. I think the fiat money is inherently unethical, regardless of the fact that it may be inevitable, in the sense that as soon as somebody starts cheating, everyone has to start playing the game. This is a really, really interesting discussion, and clearly I get a little bit heated about it, but this article was far more fair than I would have been. I would have had a really, really hard time going through a list of benefits of fiat money. But undoubtedly, any proponent of fiat money would say this is clearly what people think of as the benefit to risk argument of sovereign money. And it's not like the entire, every second of history of sovereign state money has been horrendous. It's not. I'm cherry picking out all the most terrible things that have happened for explaining my argument. But I think that's the nature of the fact that it's a bad system filled with people who are generally trying to do good. But I don't think you can fix a system with bad incentives and a bad structure by having good people in it. I don't think that fixes. I don't think it's about whether people are good or bad. I think it's about whether the system scales to societal level or not. And I think unsound money is, we've gone over this in a number of different posts and discussed it a number of different ways on this show, from writings from many different people. But I think money is the foundation of society, and I think it is explicitly sound money. Money in which you do not have to trust other people is the only money that can scale, and therefore any fiat money, any by authority money, is by its nature antithetical to society. And regardless of how well it works in the short term, over the long term, it is imbalanced in an unfixable way. The imbalance has to become obvious to the point that it's abandoned and either rebuilt or replaced with something else. There has to be essentially a reset button, and that's why we see these macro trends in society of particularly in like the dominant civilizations of these massive debts that end up swallowing up the entire system, and it collapses and then is replaced by either multiple different states or just the entire debts are wiped out, and basically one generation pays all the price of the abuse, and they start from scratch. This is not a news story. This is basically the story of society. And it happens, on the order of every, what is it? The fiat currency usually has got like a 20 to 30 something year lifespan typically. So this is by no means a rare occurrence, requires some extreme challenge. Like it's basically the natural state of things. And it's funny because it really doesn't matter how bad the imbalance is. It's like you have two bodies of water. If you send a cup from the left one to the right one, and then you go back in the opposite direction, you send a cup plus one drop to the right one, to the left one. It doesn't matter that it's just a drop, and it doesn't matter that it works fine right now. And the two bodies of water could be oceans. They could be massive. But at some point, that one drop will empty the ocean. But in an economic sense, it's in any imbalance that starts out as a drop feeds on itself. You know, it's one of those things where it's like a drop the first time, but that it's an interest. It's like interest. You know, you have $10 in debt, but then you have a 1% interest rate. So now it's $11, and then you do another $10 next time, and now it's $22, and so on and so forth. And it not only does it, not only is the imbalance getting bigger, but it's accelerating in getting bigger. So I think these are inherent issues with obviously fractional reserve banking. There's no real question about that, but just the idea of fiat money, of money by trust, if there is not a constant micro trust and collapse system, if there aren't bear markets and contractions to keep things like that in check, then you just extend what would be a four-year cycle of booms and bust into a 50-year cycle of a boom that's 50 times the size and a bust that's 50 times the size. It doesn't fix the imbalance. It just exaggerates everything, both the pain and the boom. So I would absolutely argue that some of these supposed quote-unquote benefits of fiat money, despite the fact that this is an honest interpretation of what someone would say is a benefit, I would pretty much argue that none of those benefits are really benefits. Outside of the fact that, you know, how do you defend yourself against a warring state that is cheating without doing your own cheating to, you know, confiscate the wealth from your citizenry to build a national military? So that is honestly a really fascinating take on it that I think kind of brings to light how systemic the actual situation is that, like, it may legitimately be inevitable if there is no defensible and sustainable sound money system as an alternative that can keep up with the growth of the economy and the speed of the economy, like gold failed to do. It will inherently centralize, and there may not be any way to prevent. There might not be. Fiat might be an inevitability. But we have gone on long enough. I can rant about this for a very, very long time. Definitely go drop some applause on this well-laid-out set of perceived benefits and arguments for fiat money. Again, by Suzu and Hasu, which you can find on Twitter. I will tag them both and make sure I link to them in the show notes so you can check them out and drop some applause on this article. And we will be hitting part two of this really fun little series here, again, titled A Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin, tomorrow. And like I said, hopefully part three will come out soon, and we'll be hitting that one too. Tomorrow's is titled Unpacking Bitcoin's Social Contract. So this is going to be really fun to talk about how, like, in what way is Bitcoin yet again, like what way is Bitcoin different, and what ways is Bitcoin similar to all the problems and ideas of sovereign money or state-run money that we have now. So don't forget to follow me at The Crypto Economy and on Twitter, and check out cryptoeconomy.life. You can find links to all the social media stuff I got going on up there. I got Instagram, I'm the Crypto Economy guy, Mastodon, the BitcoinHackers.org instance. I'm on Reddit. We got the R Crypto Economy subreddit, all that good stuff. But you can find it all at cryptoeconomy.life. So check that out. And if you would like to support the show, you can donate to the address that I will always have available. Thank you so much to the guys who have recently done that. And also, you can use my Amazon affiliate link while you're Christmas shopping this year. If you go through the link at the top of my page, on every page at cryptoeconomy.life, that will send me a little percentage of everything you buy, regardless of whatever it is on Amazon, just by going through that link on my website. So that's a great way to support the show, and it doesn't really cost you anything. So Thank you guys for everyone who has done that. And I will catch you all tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.